Valina Kako. Greetings, everyone. My name is Kehaolani Kawanui, and I'm your host on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. This program features the political and cultural issues of Indigenous peoples. The show is produced in the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut. This location is also known as Mattabesset, the traditional homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. On the show today, we have two main focal points. The first part will feature interviews with Nigaw Wewadum James Sinclair and Pamela Palmater, who will give us an overview of the recent Crown and First Nations Summit held on January 24, 2012 in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Prime Minister Stephen Harper and chiefs of the First Nations participated in the gathering, which had as its theme, Strengthening Our Relationship, Unlocking Our Potential. We'll hear their critical analysis of the meeting for a better understanding of the political conditions facing Indigenous peoples in relation to Canadian government. Part two of the program will focus on another recent political development, a court order in Guatemala on January 26, 2012, that ordered former military dictator Efrén Ríos Montt to stand trial on charges of the crime of genocide for his role in the 36-year war targeting Indigenous villages, where the military carried out a scorched earth campaign in the Mayan Highlands as soldiers hunted down bands of leftist guerrillas. We'll hear from Alicia Ivan Estrada and Paco de Onís about this case, as well as the newly released film Granito, How to Nail a Dictator. Now to introduce my first two guests who will share their feedback on the Canadian summit between the Crown and First Nations and zone in on the Conservative government's push to assimilate the Indigenous peoples. Nigaw Wewadum James Sinclair is an assistant professor of Native Studies and English at the University of Manitoba. He is Anishinaabe from the St. Peter's Little Pegas Indian Settlement in Manitoba. He is the co-editor of Manito Wapau, Aboriginal Writings from the Land of Water on Highwater Press, and a book titled Centering Anishinaabeg Studies, Understanding the World Through Stories, forthcoming on Michigan State University Press. Both of these volumes will appear in 2012. Pamela Palmater is a Mi'kmaq lawyer and member of the Eel River Bar First Nation in North New Brunswick. She has been a practicing lawyer for 14 years and currently holds the position of Associate Professor and Chair of Indigenous Governance in the Department of Politics and Public Administration and heads the Center for Indigenous Governance, all at Ryerson University. And she has a new book out titled Beyond Blood, Rethinking Indigenous Identity. They join me by telephone from their respective locations. Greetings, Nigaw Wewadum, James Sinclair, and Pamela Palmater. Are you both on the line?
Yes.
Yep, bonjour.
Okay, Pamela, I'm going to need you to speak up or turn the volume up on your phone.
Okay, sorry. Let me just see. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, super. Thank you both for joining us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond to talk about the First Nations Chief Meeting. Excuse me, wait a minute. Thank you both for joining us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Bonjour.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking, Nigaw, maybe you could take this first question. If you could give our listeners an overview of the First Nations Chiefs meeting with the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper.
I'd be happy to. Over the past 6 years, we've had from a minority parliament to a majority parliament, we've had Stephen Harper from the Conservative Party of Canada in government. And for the past 6 years, there's been relatively little to no movement on First Nations issues or really any mention of it beyond the scrapping of the long-negotiated Kelowna Accord, which was with the previous Liberal government.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 2 to 3 months ago, and sort of sporadically over the past few years, there's been a number of reserves throughout Canada that have hit crisis points and declared emergencies. One of them, most notably, was a community, Cree community in northern Ontario called Attawapiskut. And Attawapiskut had reached a critical point where literally the winter was coming and they were living in small shacks faced with literally near-death circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It was an emergency was declared. A lot of press was covered,
yes.
Sent to the area, and a new Democratic Party member brought it to Parliament. A lot of information came up. And in reaction, the federal government, really, to stem some of the tide, the criticisms they were receiving, declared a First Nations Summit, a Crown First Nations Summit, which would take place in January, and that happened recently last Tuesday in Ottawa. There were several hundred chiefs in attendance to discuss various issues, but for the most part, it was similar promises of programs and reports coming in the future.
Right. And now for our listeners that may be unfamiliar with Canada's federal policy on First Nations, Aboriginals, and Métis communities, how do reserves compare to reservations, just to give people a sense? Because you said that there have been these crisis situations on reserves.
Well, really, reserves are created out of the treaties and the Indian Act. They're small parcels of land scattered throughout the country, mostly in areas distant from European settlement or Canadian settlement, mm-hmm. Canadian urban areas. Some of them are close to them, but for the most part on lands that are weren't deemed as suitable for things like agriculture and urban development. A lot of swampland, my reserve, for example, is in a northern swampland. There's not a lot of difference, I don't think, so when we use the term reserves, it would be similar to large communities, but mostly in the north of Canada.
Okay, right. And now, Pamela, would you tell our listeners, what was the stated purpose of the summit? We can tell from Nigan that this was sort of sounds like a damage control meeting.
Yeah.
But what did the government say the purpose of the summit was, and what are the key issues that emerged?
Well, since before Prime Minister Stephen Harper even got into office, he had been promising various Aboriginal groups in Canada to have an actual First Minister's meeting. And here in Canada, that means a meeting between First Nations, all of the provincial and territorial premiers, as well as the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, never came about, but he made subsequent promises at each election that he would at least have a First Nation Crown meeting. And it never came, and so most First Nations thought it never would come about. And then the crisis in Attawapiskat came, and because of the sustained media attention on all of the issues, not just the housing, but the lack of food and poor health and all of that kind of thing, the meeting was called right away. And it really was to kind of deflect from the media attention,
mm-hmm.
and it worked, essentially. The problem was that it had a very targeted and restricted agenda. They only were going to talk about program areas like education, economic development, and making First Nations more accountable, interestingly enough.
Mm.
For what First Nations wanted was to deal with the hardcore issues, the immediate crisis in First Nations, but also treaty rights, our sovereignty and jurisdiction over our own nations, land rights, and all of those major unresolved issues, and the ongoing oppression because of the Indian Act. And in actual fact, I mean, I attended for the entire day at that First Nation Crown Summit, and nothing was accomplished at that summit. There was no commitment to funding, no emergency plan for any of these First Nations that are in a very severe way, and certainly no commitments on treaties, land, jurisdiction, and sovereignty. It was, again, just some very loose promises around certain program areas,
mm-hmm.
but no funding attached.
I see. And now, Nigan mentioned the Indian Act, and you've just mentioned mm-hmm. that the government was trying to put the issue of responsibility back on the First Nations.
Yeah.
When it sounds like the federal government has actually been abdicating its responsibility, what does it mean, on the one hand, for the federal government to have something like the Indian Act, which is their attempt to bind First Nations to the federal government, and then have them not actually follow through? Could you give our listeners a sense of what the Indian Act is historically and how it functions today in 21st century Canada?
Well, it's really pretty ironic because you have this Indian Act, which is a colonially imposed legislation, you know, completely resisted by First Nations, and it really came about because of the way we have divided our jurisdiction between federal and provincial and territorial governments. The federal government assumed that it had jurisdiction over, quote, Indians and lands reserved for Indians,
mm-hmm.
Despite enacting the Indian Act, has abdicated its responsibilities by chronically underfunding programs and services and pretty much ignoring treaty land claims and sovereignty issues. But the thing about the Indian Act that a lot of people don't realize here in Canada is that Indian and Northern Affairs, which is the federal department that manages it, very much like the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
Takes you from birth to death. So it doesn't just deal with a program area. It talks about who's entitled to even be considered an Indian, who can be a member of a band, how the reserve lands will be set up and used, whether they can be leased, whether permits will be issued, band governance, so the imposition of chiefs and council kind of form of governance, what kind of powers they have. Many of them are really laughable. I mean, they're allowed to regulate things like beekeeping and fences and that kind of thing, nothing related to anything substantial. And then it takes you right to death because it talks about estates and who can pass on wealth and when and who gets to approve it. And the majority of the power vests with the Minister of Indian Affairs. So everything has to go through the Department of Indian Affairs. And for listeners who are unfamiliar with just how much Indian Affairs controls our lives, of the $9.5 to $10 billion that's set aside for Indian Affairs here in Canada, half of that goes just to fund the ever-increasing bureaucracy at Indian Affairs. So right off the bat, we're getting 50 cents on every dollar. So imagine, add on top of that the chronic underfunding, and it's just insane. And so at this First Nation Crown gathering, you really saw a divide. It was purported by the media to be a joint action plan, but you had on one hand the Conservative government under Prime Minister Harper saying, we are not getting rid of the Indian Act, we're keeping it, and what we're going to do is introduce a whole bunch more new legislative amendments. And on the other side, you have the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, our national organization, much like the Congress of American Indians, saying, wait a second, we want to get rid of the Indian Act. We're talking about sovereignty and inherent rights and, you know, managing our own communities. And so they were talking completely different languages on how to move forward.
Right. Nigan, would you like to comment on the government's refusal to repeal the Act?
Well, the interesting thing about the Act is that there are remnants that are coming back from the original implementation in 1876 that are still present. So one of the important things that, I mean, Pam mentioned really the laundry list of draconian controls that were placed onto Aboriginal people throughout Canada by the Indian Act, and the one thing that is perhaps we're living in the biggest legacy of is residential schools. The Indian Act was intended to, as a measure to eventually rid itself, Canada to rid itself of Indians, and that involved not only the identification of Indians, which is built on a blood quantum theory of sort of eventual reduction to nothingness, to no longer being an Indian, but also residential schools, which were, schooling was mandatory, required within the Indian Act, forced, of course, which allowed police to come in and literally steal children and place them into faraway schools, Christian-denominated and so forth, and that history is well documented. We're still living in that legacy of that act. We're very deep in the shadow of all of these legacies, and the Indian Act has, of course, changed. One of the discomforts I think a lot of chiefs have with removing it outright, and that's there is a bit of a fracture with it in and amongst the chiefs, is that there's what would replace it? What would be the kind of document that would indicate a relationship between First Nations and the federal government? So there is a movement, odd as it may be, to maintain the Indian Act. But then, of course, there's also a much, much larger group of chiefs who are interested in scrapping it and moving on of whatever that next step may be, whether it be a new act or whether it be something totally different altogether, which involves things like individual partnerships with the federal government on a band-to-government basis. That's a bit more difficult to manage. But the issue as it's sort of coming up is that the federal government is very interested in status quo politics, in maintaining the strategy as it always has been, which is controlling the movements, controlling the abilities, the choices, and then ultimately the ability to self-determine. And so the Indian Act, as it maintains, as it continues, that's much harder to struggle up against. However, the most interesting thing for me is that First Nations are doing it anyways. So you saw a little bit in this gathering of leaders who are, albeit in a draconian system, are still finding ways around it anyways.
Can you give an example?
Well, there's some interesting moves in Manitoba here, and then also in British Columbia around, which of course have much different treaties than anyone else. They're still negotiating treaties out in British Columbia to negotiate separate agreements external to the Indian Act, and which lead to certain methods of self-determination, and that's a rather controversial move to try to move outside of the Indian Act. But there's steps within British Columbia, like to make things like businesses on reserves and then individual property rights mm-hmm. or collective property rights owned by reserves or owned by tribal communities. And that's certainly debatable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that sounds resonant with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in terms of the corporate model.
Yeah. And I guess that would lead to things like the reaction of the government to things like the First Nations Property Act. And one of the concerns is always with the federal government is their interest in turning reserves into municipalities. So that changes that Crown First Nations relationship as nation-to-nation relationships.
Yes, and Pamela, you have an analysis of that First Nation Property Ownership Act. Could you speak more to that as well?
Well, sure. It's part of the suite of legislation that the federal government is trying to and has been successful in the past in imposing on First Nations against the near unanimous opposition to the majority of these bills. So the ones that have been imposed already are Bill C-3, which were amendments to the registration provisions of the Indian Act, which determines who can be an Indian and who can't, mm-hmm. and it essentially preserves the notional, not actual, blood quantum rules in the Act. C-67, which was about imposing the Canadian human rights laws and codes on First Nations. But you have a whole new suite of legislation that you can see a very clear pattern, a very assimilatory legislative objective that maintains control in the federal government. So you have S-2, which deals with matrimonial real property on reserve, which is sold as providing equality for Indigenous women on reserve, but in actual fact, the key thing that it does do is it opens up lands for the first time on reserve to use and occupation by non-Indians. So it's that first step down that path to losing our Indigenous lands. But the other thing is this First Nation Property Ownership Act, which it's not new, certainly. Hernando de Soto has been traveling all over the world saying Indigenous people will be better off if they each own as individuals little parcels of land that they can then go into debt and obtain mortgages and create businesses and such. We also have the Dawes Act, which many First Nations or tribal governments in the United States will be very familiar with. It resulted in a massive loss of Indigenous lands in the United States, much of which they were never able to get back, and has resulted in a great deal of checkerboarding on reserve. So this is being promoted here in Canada by the number one, I guess, assimilationist. He's an academic, Tom Flanagan, who actually promotes assimilation as a policy objective of government. And it looks like the Conservative government has really latched on to it. So instead of calling it what it is, mm-hmm. an assimilation plan, a plan to really break up communities, because when you talk like that, people get offended. The way they're kind of selling it now is unlocking the economic potential of First Nations territories for the, quote, maximize benefit of all Canadians.
Absolutely.
So it's if you look at the wording, they use code words mm-hmm. so that they're not so, obvious. But basically the plan is to take our lands, which are held communally, most of which were set up by treaties, about two-thirds of them. They're constitutionally protected, which means, they're protected by Canada's supreme laws. And they're going to pass this legislation which will allow First Nations to parcel out these lands to individuals, which can then be used to create businesses or just to sell to non-Indians. And if you can imagine that we have approximately a third of our 634 First Nations in this country who live in extreme situations of poverty, mm-hmm. who have no access to things like even running water and sanitation, how quickly those lands would be lost.
Right.
And even those who are promoting it, have said, well, yes, that'll be a challenge, but we trust our people not to do that. Oh. I mean, it's really disingenuous.
Well, and you mentioned the General Allotment Act. Listeners, if you're unfamiliar with that U.S. legislation, that's an act from 1887, which, as Pamela pointed out, was absolutely disastrous for the tribal nations in terms of collective land holdings. It's actually how land holdings were dismantled by collectivities, that is, the tribes holding them collectively.
Yeah.
This language of unlocking just sounds like corporate branding bull.
Mm-hmm. It is, and they use that kind of code all throughout. You know, they're talking about maximizing benefits for Canadians as opposed to First Nations. They're talking about promoting the success of individuals. So not of, you know, promoting the sovereignty, jurisdiction, and well-being of First Nation as nations,
right,
but very much focusing on individuals. And this First Nation Property Ownership Act is really just a part of it. But they're able to sell it in the sense that they attach the act to wealth, that somehow the second you get an individual piece of fee simple land, that has solved 500 years of colonization, residential schools, and chronic poverty, and that overnight you will just be able to open up a Walmart on your little one-acre piece of land and
yeah,
somehow be wealthy and solve all your own problems.
Right.
And if you look at the actual speech that the minister gave, he said that it's the, quote, incentives that are in the Indian Act that has resulted in the poverty in our First Nations, as opposed to the 500 years of colonially imposed laws, rules, and regulations and the chronic underfunding.
Right, right.
The language is always of economics, and that's,
yeah,
there's no interest in discussing things along social and justice, social issues, justice issues. And if it is, it's always in the discourse of it's the First Nations problem. So it's somehow they're resisting common sense things, and that's,
yeah,
was that move recently. There's a recent decision to apply human rights on reserves, and the Conservatives are very proud of this. And as if First Nations were somehow resisting human rights.
Yes, exactly. And the other thing I meant to say is that the actual book that this is originating with, Tom Flanagan's book, in his book, he says that First Nations are actually primitive communists, and that our communal ideas of protecting the land for the whole community and for future generations is a, quote, threat to Canadian democracy. So imagine when you talk about our rights and our communities like that, you really set up this kind of fear mentality, you know, about us being communists or socialists or something that's threatening. It's always this really aggressive, negative terminology that's used.
Right. Well, and he may as well have just come out and called y'all savages.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, we certainly know that it's very interesting to see it playing out in the sort of political arena right now, because those of us in literature know it very well, in pop culture and et cetera. But really, it's living forth in a sort of narrative that's taking place right now. And it's being used as a common sense discourse that First Nations, why don't you just get it? Why don't you just get it and become municipalities, individual little capitalists? And no, we don't want to talk about group ownership or the fact that they've, in fact, the Indian Act set up the system that's created the poverty in the first place. The Indian Act sets up so that no one on reserve can really get credit of any kind, including the Band Council itself, because everything can't be seized. Nothing can be seized by the government for things like mortgages or credit or so forth. So that discussion never takes place of how a community could get credit, could begin businesses on reserve.
Right.
That's just not even a starter.
Right. Well, we need to wrap up because we're just out of time, but I wanted to ask if you could end on the note of traditional collective values and what's at stake in this push to privatize.
If you go around, especially in my area of the world, in Manitoba, communities have a very unique relationship amongst themselves, which create nations, but it's the important thing to understand about Anishinaabe Nation here in Manitoba, and kind of throughout Anishinaabe country, and applies as well to our other relatives in the area, is that we have not only relationships to each other, but we also have it to the earth. And that is as much a part of nationhood as anything else, including relationships with non-Anishinaabe or non-Aboriginal people as well. And so when you have a sense of collective ownership, that not only is the nation owning the property, but also that there's a responsibility for the people sharing that land next door to have to recognize that group as a group. That sense of collective ownership that's deeply embedded within the language, the culture, those questioning those things and applying an individual-only model drives to the heart of assimilation.
Right.
Applies to assimilation in the worst form. It's an absolute disrespect of an innate cultural value around having a relationship with that land, with those animals, and then also with the people next door.
Mm.
So recognizing that is going to be a big struggle. That's going to be a big struggle to get this government to recognize that, if at all.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you both so much for being on the show. It's really a pleasure to talk with you and have this important dialogue. And thank you for keeping us abreast of some of the political conditions going on north of the U.S.-Canada border.
Well, Alan, thank you.
We'll be in touch. Mahalo. And listeners, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehal Lani Kawanui. We just heard from Niga Waywidum, James Sinclair, as well as Pamela Palmater, giving a critical analysis of the recent Crown and First Nations Summit held in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Now, on to the second part of our show. On January 26, 2012, Guatemala's former military dictator, Efrain Rios Montt, was ordered to stand trial on charges of the crime of genocide and crimes against humanity. The prosecution spent hours presenting overwhelming evidence in the form of military documents, exhumation reports, and photos linking Rios Montt directly to hundreds of deaths and disappearances that took place during Guatemala's 36-year civil war that killed 200,000 people. During the 17 months of Rios Montt's rule in 1982 and 1983, the military carried out a scorched-earth campaign in the Maya Highlands. My next guests will discuss this recent political development. Alicia Ivan Estrada will offer us a historical overview of the war, what qualifies it as genocidal, and the court hearing charging Rios Montt. In addition, I'll bring on Paco de Onís, producer of the new documentary film titled Granito, How to Nail a Dictator. The film is a story of five main individuals whose destinies are joined by Guatemala's past and how an earlier documentary film from 1982 is intertwined with the nation's turbulent history. In Granito, the film's director, Pamela Yates, and four other key people sift for clues buried in archives and historical memory, seeking to uncover evidence to literally nail this dictator. That earlier film was also directed by Yates. Back in 1982, it's titled When the Mountains Tremble, and in it, Guatemalan dictator Efrain Rios Montt makes a politically, potentially damning claim that helps the five people piece together evidence to support the recent legal case against him. And now to introduce these two guests. Alicia Ivan Estrada is an assistant professor in the Chicano-Chicana Studies Department at California State University at Northridge. Her research focuses on Maya cultural productions in Guatemala and the U.S. Her current project is a book manuscript on Maya Guatemalan diaspora communities in Los Angeles. In addition, since 2006, she has worked with the Maya radio program Contacto Ancestral, which airs every Monday night on KPFK. And we will also hear from Paco de Onís. He is a film producer based in New York City. His most recent production is a film and educational media project about the International Criminal Court titled The Reckoning. Prior to the ICC project, he produced State of Fear, a Skylight Pictures film about Peru's 20-year war on terror, based on the findings of the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He has produced numerous documentaries for PBS, and as I mentioned, he is the producer of Granito, How to Nail a Dictator. They join me by telephone from Los Angeles and New York City, respectively. Greetings, are you both on the line?
Yes.
Thank you for taking time to join us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show to talk about this important case.
It's wonderful to be here.
Wonderful to be here as well. Thank you.
I want to start by asking Professor Estrada, can you provide an overview about the war period and the U.S. involvement in it and how this amounts to genocide and the impact on Maya communities?
Yes, thank you. Well, first, Guatemala is a very diverse country. 70% of the population is Maya, and by Maya we mean a population that has a shared history and cultural and spiritual practices, even though there are 20 different linguistic Maya languages spoken. In December 29th, 1996, the peace accords officially ended in Guatemala, a 36-year civil war. This is one of the longest and bloodiest wars in the Americas. The United Nations Truth Commission report after the war notes that over 200,000 Guatemalans were killed during this period.
Mm.
Over 40 to 50,000 Guatemalans were forcibly disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
This totals about one-third of the total cases of disappeared folks in the Americas. 1 million were displaced, many living in exile or as refugees, primarily in Mexico, also a very large population in the United States as a result of the war and that displacement. 150,000 widows. 95% of these crimes were committed by the military, police forces, or government officials. So there's a very clear systematic effort to eradicate, particularly the Maya community, since over 440 Maya communities were completely erased or wiped out by the military. Mm. 83% of these over 200,000 Guatemalans that were killed were Maya. Now, the United Nations Truth Commission report, which was released in February of 1999, also stated that the number of these massacres were carried out in the early parts of the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
and that they had a very clear intention of genocide. Now, this is the period in which General Efraín Ríos Montt was in power. One of the aspects of genocide, or one of the reasons why the Truth Commission states that there were intentions of genocide, is because Maya women, particularly pregnant Maya women, were especially targeted by the military.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these women's bellies were often sliced open by the soldiers. Their children, babies, and fetuses were purposely killed by the military as part of their campaign of terror, but also as a way of eliminating future Maya generations,
right.
Since they believed that, you know, many of them would potentially become guerrillas. They also killed elders in the community as a way of eradicating ancestral knowledge. And the Truth Commission, you know, emphasizes the fact that they use sexual violence against women. Oftentimes the sexual violence was done in public spaces,
mm-hmm.
as a way of humiliating women, but also as a way of also disempowering the community.
Yes.
This 36-year civil war has a very clear U.S. involvement. In fact, in March of 1999, then-President Bill Clinton apologized publicly to the Guatemalan peoples for the U.S. involvement in the war. The involvement can be traced even before the war, in 1954, when the United States helped lead a coup against democratically elected President Jacobo Arbenz. The coup was led because Jacobo Arbenz had passed a land reform, an agrarian reform, that would benefit, in fact, much of the Maya community in Guatemala. And the United States saw this as a communist threat, particularly because it threatened the interest of the United Fruit Company, a company where U.S. Congress representatives had shares.
Mm-hmm.
And so it impacted their interests. During the Civil War from 1960 to 1996, the United States provided millions of dollars to the Guatemalan military. This not only created much political power, but economic power for the military. Guatemala
mm-hmm.
has, even to date, a military bank. It also provided training to many of these generals at the School of the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
General Efraín Ríos Montt assisted the School of the Americas in 1951, as also General Otto Pérez Molina, the current president of Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
It provided equipment. And I think also it denied the war at every level. The news, there's hardly any visibility about what was taking place in Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And the refugee laws or asylum cases were continuously denied. Less than 1% of asylum cases of people fleeing the war were granted asylum in the United States. And so it's for those reasons that, President Bill Clinton in 1999 apologizes to the Guatemalan people.
Can you tell us when the case against the general started?
Now, the specific case against General Efrain Rios Mon started in 2001. And this case came to court on Thursday, January 26th. And charges, formal charges, were applied against Rios Mon on Thursday, January 26th.
That's this year, folks, 2012.
That's right. Now, some of the documents used in support of the case were specifically the United Nations Truth Commission report that I just detailed some of the points.
Mm-hmm.
Testimonies that are incorporated in the Truth Commission's report, as well as testimonies from survivors. In fact, one of the testimonies that Judge Carol Flores mentioned during the court case on the 26th of January was of a woman talking about the ways in which soldiers killed babies by smashing their heads on rocks. Survivor testimonies, also military documents made public by the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
specifically the military document called Operación Sofía or Operation Sofía. This document is dated July 8th through August 20th of 1982. During the regime of General Efrain Rios Mon. In the document, it details the ways in which the military attempted to eradicate, specifically the Maya Ishil community. The document contains original planning documents, telegrams, maps, patrol reports, and it's signed. They're officially signed by the generals in charge,
mm-hmm.
and it illustrates that General Efrain Rios Mon was aware of these systematic tactics, as well as the Vice Minister of Defense at the time, General Mejia Victores. In addition to those documents, video clips were used at the trial on January 26th, and the video clips came from a video taken by Director Pamela Yates, and some of these clips appeared in a documentary called Granito, How to Nail the Dictator.
May I ask you, you mentioned the national security documents that are in Washington, D.C., and those archives. Were those the ones that actually Clinton made publicly available that had been actually submerged before that?
These are documents that Kate Doyle, who is the director of the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C., made available
okay.
to the public.
Excellent. Yes, and I did see her in the film. Before we turn it over to our film producer, I want to ask you, though, Alicia, what do you think accounts for the fact that this is such a buried past and still remains in many ways a hidden war?
I think there's a couple of factors. On the one hand, even though the peace accords were signed, 15 years ago, the military in Guatemala continues to hold social, economic, and political power.
Mm-hmm.
The very perpetrators, the very, generals that waged this genocide are still in power. On the other hand, I also think that it's, a way of hiding the direct involvement that our government in the United States had
mm-hmm.
in the war, and the ways in which very limited media attention has been paid or given to the genocide. I would leave it at that. I mean, there are other factors, but I think those are the two sort of main factors.
Right.
As to why it's so invisible.
Just one other thing, a thought regarding why, when you said, why is it a hidden war? I just wanted to add one thing, which is, I noticed that in Peru, it's the same thing. People don't know about the amount of people that died in Peru during the conflict there, which is about 70,000. And in Guatemala, 200,000. And yet, the Argentina and Chile conflict have a lot more attention. And I always wonder if it's because in Peru and in Guatemala, they were indigenous people that were
mm-hmm,
being killed.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right.
So they're kind of invisible in that sense, because
mm-hmm.
in Argentina it was 30,000 disappeared, and in Chile it was something like 3,000. I mean, so not to say that I'm just saying the numbers, they're not even close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really mm-hmm. strange that, mm-hmm. The genocide in Guatemala is practically unknown. Even there was a book written called America in the Age of Genocide, which talked about all these genocides in Europe, the Balkans, etc. And it didn't even mention Guatemala. And the Guatemalan genocide was perpetrated with a lot of U.S. help.
Yes.
So it's just amazing to me that it's so hidden.
Yes.
You know, we get that comment all the time after at screenings in the Q&As. People say, I didn't even know about this. I had no idea.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And that should also give people on the immigration debate food for thought in terms of how they're framing this and what the kinds of presumptions are made in terms of assuming why people come here. We really need a critical look at the role that the U.S. plays in these regions and that there's a direct connection between migrants coming here and the role that the U.S. plays in the upheaval of those societies in very violent ways.
Absolutely.
And Alicia, I know that you work with Maya Guatemalan diaspora communities in Los Angeles, and you must see the compounded trauma that contemporary Maya still experience from this period of the war. I want to turn it over to Paco now. Paco, you have been screening the film with Maya communities in the Northeast, right?
Yes, we had a screening in New Bedford, Massachusetts on January 29th for a Maya community group that is based in New Bedford. And a lot of the people who came were around 30 years old, and so they were seeing their history for the first time.
Mm.
After the screening, several of them mentioned that these stories, they never get told. They don't know anything about the war. They said the history that they were taught in Guatemala kind of is that the Spaniards arrived, they were colonized, and then suddenly it's today. I mean, the whole period of the war in Guatemala is not taught. And we had the same experience when we were screening in Guatemala. When we were filming Granito, we were often asked to show the film that basically led to Granito, which is When the Mountains Tremble, the film that Pamela Yates made in 1982.
Yes.
And which was used as evidence in the case against General Efrain Rios Montt. So this issue of the hidden history, buried history, is really an important one, and we found that with Guatemalan youth, they get quite outraged that this history has been denied to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we've created a historic memory project, which would essentially be a public archive of the memories of the Guatemalan people, both in Guatemala and in the diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the U.S., there are 1.3 million Guatemalans. And the ones that I was speaking to at the screening in New Bedford were all, mostly young, and they have stories that they've heard from their grandparents, their parents, their uncles. Some of them themselves, when they were really little, they still remember things that happened before they left Guatemala. I mean, the connection between the genocide and the people of Guatemala that are living here, it's so direct, and whenever we have these screenings, we feel like, as Rigoberta Menchú, the Nobel Peace Laureate that is in both films, When the Mountains Tremble and Granito, she told me once, when I asked her, why is it that a screening of a film elicits all these stories, she said, because the film creates a safe space where people can actually share these stories. They share the story of the film because they're all watching it together. And then it sort of creates a catalyst for the sharing of stories amongst themselves. And so now we want to take that catalyst one step further and have them upload these stories on video up to the site, Granito Every Memory Matters, which is granito.com. So we're just about to launch that site. And we really want to hand it over to the Guatemalan people, and our hope is that it will become a public archive for the Guatemalan people, where they can share their stories and see their hidden history.
Incredible. That's granito.com?
Well, no, Granito, E-M-M, because it's Granito Every Memory Matters. So granitoemm.com.
Okay, excellent. Now, to go back to the film, Granito, How to Nail a Dictator, Paco, how did you come to produce this film? This is such an amazing story. And as Alicia mentioned, so much of it draws on the earlier footage that Pamela Yates had from her 1982 film, When the Mountains Tremble, where she's literally going into her own film archive of old outtakes that she didn't use and looking at them 30 years later.
Right. Well, the way that happened is that When the Mountains Tremble was banned in Guatemala for 20 years. It was never shown publicly. We found out later that it was shown in a clandestine way. It was passed around. People had made copies of VHS to VHS, and you know, degraded copies were passed around in the resistance movement. But the first public showing was in 2003, 20 years after the film came out. And at that screening in Guatemala City, there was one of the lawyers of the case against Reels Montt. And that lawyer asked us if there might be footage that's not in When the Mountains Tremble, that was left on the cutting room floor, so to speak, which was a smart question. And she obviously knew something about filmmaking. And we said, yes, we've kept everything. It's in a warehouse in New Jersey. You know, we haven't thrown anything away. So that led to a five-month project of going through all the old film and lining up the sound tapes again with the film, because back then they were recording, or they were separate. And so it was a big process. But at the end of it, we ended up with about 7 hours of what we thought could be strong evidence to be used in the case. And we handed it over, as you can see in Granito, and Pamela goes to the Spanish court where the case was taken and hands the evidence over. That evidence now moved from the Spanish court to the Guatemalan courts. And so on Thursday, January 26th, General Efrain Reels Montt had to appear in court. And during the court appearance, footage from Granito was shown by the prosecutor as part of the evidence. Another piece of evidence, which I think should be mentioned, is the forensic anthropology evidence, the bones, essentially, which is for another big part. So there's the military archives, there's the personal testimonies, there are and the filmic outtakes, and the bones, and the analysis of how people were killed, studying their bones, which showed that most of the people that were killed by the military were killed point blank. They weren't killed in combat, as the military was always trying to claim. But the evidence is quite clear that it's not. And children, too. You know, children who were shot through the head. And, you know, it was just horrible. The crimes and the way they were committed, the level of cruelty, just really beyond belief.
Yes, absolutely. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, I am on the show here today with Alicia Ivan Estrada, assistant professor in the Chicano Studies Department at California State University at Northridge. Her research focuses on Maya cultural productions in Guatemala and the United States. And I'm also speaking with Paco de Onís, a film producer who is talking about the new film called Granito, How to Nail a Dictator. That film will be screening on POV on PBS this year, 2012. This film actually documents the role that Pamela Yates, as a film director, plays using excerpts from her 1982 film, When the Mountains Tremble, in which Guatemalan dictator Efrain Reels Montt makes a potentially damning claim. And regarding the January 26th court hearing that Paco was just talking about, this was the first time ever that this former military dictator was ordered to stand trial on charges of genocide. Paco, Alicia, this is a huge victory for the victims and survivors of the Guatemalan genocide, human rights defenders, and the lawyers' efforts worldwide. And again, though, this is just him facing charges of genocide and crimes against humanity. Paco, could you tell us something about what took place outside the court at the Human Rights Plaza?
Yeah, because, you know, in these cases, and we've done a lot of films about cases of perpetrators finally facing justice, like Fujimori in Peru. It's so important to the victims that the fact that he even appeared in court. So it sounds like he's just facing charges, like it's not much. But for the victims, it's huge. And thousands of Maya people came down from the highlands, including Antonio, who is figures in Granito. You know, Antonio Cava, he and his whole community They came down. They were all in the plaza, which has now been dubbed the Human Rights Plaza, where actually a big monitor screen was out there in the plaza. And people, those proceedings went on from 9 in the morning till 9 at night.
Mm.
People were there with lit candles, crying. And when the judge finally said, you know what, this case is going to go forward, there's enough evidence, and, you know, Rios Montt has to be under house arrest, and we're going to set a trial date, the whole plaza erupted in cheers, and, you know, fireworks went up into the air. It was just a jubilation that finally some measure of justice was happening. So even though it's just the initial appearance, the fact that Rios Montt had to stand before a judge, and the judge, you know, ordered him to be there and said that he was going to have to come back, there was going to be a trial, that was just absolutely huge. A momentous day in Guatemala for justice.
In the diaspora as well. I mean, I think all of us living outside of Guatemala and the Maya diaspora, particularly in Los Angeles, one of the largest outside of Guatemala, the largest Maya community in Los Angeles, was very much in tune or, you know, wanting to know what was taking place in that courtroom. And, mm-hmm. and you're right, Paco, in saying that it may just seem like a charge and it's not a big sort of point in the process, in this very long process, but definitely there is a sense of a process of justice finally happening. I know that a number of folks, you know, told us that they never thought that this day would ever come
mm-hmm.
when Rios Montt would be sitting in trial. And the, you know, the judge's, you know, description of some of the testimonies and the judge also stating that, you know, what took place in Guatemala and the impunity that has taken place, you know, hindered any kind of process of peace in Guatemala was incredibly important.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of that, I mean, if you want to see some of the reactions, we have a Facebook page dedicated to Granito. It's called, just look for Granito Film on Facebook. And come to the page, you know, like the page, you can join in because there's a tremendous discussion going on there in English and Spanish for this news. And it's been going on for months now with the rollout of the film. So you can really see the reactions of people. It's quite something. And Rios Montt had to sit there for an entire day, seeing the evidence and including the film clips from our film, which Pam did in an interview with him back in 1982, where he says, of course I'm in charge of the Army. If I'm not in charge of the Army, then who is? Well, you know.
Yes.
He said it. The Guatemala News has been, the television stories, they've been using that clip for the last few days.
Right. And I did see that in there. I've seen that clip circulating, but I also just want to congratulate you on an incredibly powerful film that I was able to see through the preview copy. And we need to wrap up the interview now, but I want to let listeners know and reiterate that Granito, How to Nail a Dictator, will be screened on PBS's Point of View, POV series. But if you don't want to wait for that, you can go to the website for more information. Could you leave us with that website, Paco?
Yeah, you can just go to granitofilm.com.
Okay.
And that'll lead you to everything else.
Okay. Thank you both so much for joining us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. This is a really important case, and I thank you for sharing this information with our listeners. Mahalo.
Thank you. Thank you for having
thank
us on
you
your
so
show.
Much.
Gracias.
Thank you.
You're listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. And before I close out the show, I want to acknowledge the stations that syndicate this program. WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, WAZU in Peoria, Illinois, KUCR in Riverside, California, WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut and Montauk, New York, WNJR in Washington, Pennsylvania, WETXLP, the Independent Voice of Appalachia, which broadcasts throughout the Tri-Cities region of East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, and Northwest North Carolina, WBCRLP in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and WORT in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo.